The Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations Fund has announced the launch of a gala dinner to celebrate 5 decades of leadership and achievement that they have made to the community. The dinner is scheduled for Tuesday, October the 15th at the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. Malcolm has mentioned this dinner already. To our audience, those of you who would like to place reservations, is a very easy email address. We could be in touch with the dinner planning committee. Gala 2013 at conferenceofpresidents.org. Again, that's Gala 2013 at conferenceofpresidents.org. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Hohnlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you.
Plans for the dinner, I hope, are going well.
Actually going very well, and it's the first dinner we've done in 20 years, and we'll honor all the chairmen over this period, people who really devoted themselves to the community and done so much, and God willing, it'll be 20 years before the next dinner. So people will have one opportunity in 2 decades.
You know, there are a lot of organizations that like to follow your model, you know, a dinner every 20 years. What are these rumors that I'm presenting you with your big tribute that night? Any truth to that?
I don't know. I guess we'll have to check the rumors out.
I have a way of making you speechless sometimes, huh?
Yes.
Unbelievable. A lot of folks in this audience, Malcolm, as you can imagine, I'm sure, look, you know the different audiences that you address, and you know the general makeup of the people in this audience, and a lot of people are quite unhappy with what the Prime Minister of Israel has done to, quote-unquote, restart the peace process, and of course, the biggest gesture, maybe the only one you could tell us, was this agreement to a prisoner release. So number one, has the prisoner release already taken place? And number two, much more important, why do you think the Prime Minister had to make this move?
The release hasn't taken place, and it will take place only over an extended period to see whether the Palestinians actually undertake reciprocal moves and whether they live up to their commitment to that they've made to the Secretary of State and to joining the, quote, process. It's not just some people. I think a majority of people in Israel have expressed reservations on the specific gesture, and because some of those who were released or plan to be released are Israeli Arabs who committed crimes, and this sends a particular message that if you're including Israeli Arabs, are you putting them under the theoretical representation of the Palestinian Authority? Second, there are many with blood on their hands, people responsible for the killings of people, which was a principle that was adhered to at one time, but it's been violated in past agreements. And the question of Israel always making the gestures and always having the burden, and with the question, and we had a meeting yesterday with officials in Washington and discussed these issues very openly and laid out the concerns that I think many people have. And they know it. I mean, they understand the concern, and obviously the Prime Minister made a decision, and I saw him in Israel recently, but before the announcement of the prisoner deal, just before it. And he is committed to trying to see the process, and he can't be pictured as the one who has blocked it. With the threat of action at the UN General Assembly coming up in just a few weeks in September, the threat of the European boycotts, the threats of the other gesture, which to many people may seem insignificant, are in fact very significant. And the further isolation, the augmentation of the delegitimization campaign, there are many things that are tied to the calculus of the Prime Minister's decision. And, you know, time will again judge the wisdom or lack of wisdom of any particular move, but the polls show that the Israelis do want to have peace and do want the process to succeed. They are skeptical of the other side, just as the other side, some people when polled, expressed a similar skepticism.
Right. I mean, if not for the distance or the very short distance to the UN General Assembly, do you think if it was a different time of year, it would have been handled differently?
It certainly is a pressure point. And again, people dismiss the UN. It's not to be dismissed. The recognition by perhaps 63 agencies, and you know automatically there is a majority for any Palestinian initiative, would have implications. And it is the Palestinian direction, certainly Abbas has appeared to prefer and to have followed a path which would not involve negotiations, but would be unilateral moves like he did at the United Nations, going to the International Criminal Court, many other things that he would do unilaterally. And if he went around the world, it gets recognition from the vast majority of the countries of the world. So I think the timing is important. It's not the single calculation that would drive the prime minister making the deal. I do think he wanted to show that Israel was prepared to take the steps necessary to make the peace talks possible. I'm sure he was encouraged to do it. He did say that he felt the United States was fair and that there was no ultimatum given to Israel to say you either do this or...
Well, for some people that makes it even worse, but all right. Look, you've had experience with everybody on the, from the political left to the political right, everybody in between in Israel. Do you think there's a level of discomfort from everybody when it comes to a move like this, or some people are really happy about the prime minister's decision?
No, nobody's happy about... Well, I can't say nobody. It's
right.
Certainly a very... distinct minority might be pleased.
So there's a level of discomfort among everybody.
Even those who want to see the process move forward, and even those who may be advocates, very strong advocates for the negotiations, I have a feeling in their stomachs that when they see this, they see the families' reactions, when they know what these people did, and know that a certain percentage will always be recidivists, will always come back and again engage in terrorism, as we saw already with those released for Gilad Shalit.
Yep.
And you remember there was strong opposition at that time also.
Yeah. And if they don't go ahead and commit crimes, they'll certainly encourage others to do so.
Right.
Did any of this catch you by surprise? Because it seemed to us, those who just, you know, read the news and observe it, that it sort of came out of nowhere, just like this new peace process seemed to really come out of nowhere. You being an insider, did you see all these small steps being taken to get to this point where they're literally at the table again?
Well, I saw the five or six trips before the release of Secretary Kerry. We saw a singular commitment to this and to initiating the process, which really hasn't begun. We've only seen the preliminaries to the process at this point. And I know that Netanyahu never wants Israel to be the one that they point to and carries the burden of blame and responsibility in these kind of situations, although when it comes to violating security and other considerations, he has. And I will tell you that he was very tough on this. This wasn't just a simple move where one day he decides to give this large number, 104 prisoners. There were very tough discussions and back and forth before this was arrived at, and that it wasn't done at once, and it wasn't done preliminary to the negotiations. It's only concurrent with the negotiations.
Right.
And so not violating what he said that there would be no preconditions, this will be done only during the course of the negotiations. So I did know some of these things. I did not know that 104 prisoners would be part of the equation.
There seems to be a lot of opposition. Maybe a lot is the wrong word. Certainly question marks about Martin Indyk's participation in all of this, in the process, in the talks, etc. If that's the case, that there's been some significant vocal opposition, how did he get the job back? Like, how did he sneak back into the picture?
Well, I don't think he snuck back. He's been very involved. He's vice president of the Brookings Institution. He's written a lot on this. He's been involved all along in international affairs in the Washington scene. There were other candidates to whom people objected, and I think he was the most, probably the most acceptable. This is also a matter of chemistry. When secretaries, others, presidents appoint people, they often, it's somebody that they've worked with in the past, that they knew, that they had some interaction with. So I know both sides have expressed reservations about him actually participating in the negotiations. I think he will be going to Israel in the next couple of days and meeting with both the PA and Prime Minister Netanyahu. I think that he will play a role not to dictate, but to facilitate, to be an ongoing presence for the secretary. But and I think that his role is in some places being exaggerated. So we will have to see how it plays out.
So for those who are questionable about, or skeptical rather, about his participation, it may not be as much as we think. In terms of your personal reaction, I would guess that that privately you've said, you know, obviously, whatever you want to say regarding the situation, but publicly there's no reason to say anything other than hopefully he could advance the process, right?
Not subject to Senate approval. It's not something in which you right. have a vote. Secretary can appoint who he wants. I've known Martin for a long time. We've had our differences, but this is a decision of the secretary, and the parties will decide how they will relate and will judge by what he does. There were other candidates, I think, that people might have found more objectionable. I think there were
right.
you know, always options. You have to look at the spectrum to see who's best.
Right. Earlier in this conversation, you used the words European boycott. So you got to explain to what extent that is and what it means practically. And secondly, it does seem, again, to those who observe the news, that the European-Israeli relationship, as shaky as it's always been, has been even shakier over the last year or so. Why is that?
That's a really good question, because people tend to dismiss the gestures or these decisions by the EU, for instance, regarding products on the West Bank, and in this case, it's about anybody receiving money from the EU, only from the EU, not from its member states, but this is directly from the EU, and this amounts to a lot of money in and of itself for grants, let's say for research, for health, for other things, which impacts many institutions and even businesses. If they have a presence in the West Bank, in other words, put money into it, they will not be eligible. And one of the companies that's always cited is SodaStream, not because they right. receive money, but because they have a huge presence in Ma'ale Adumim.
Right.
But it means that thousands of the Palestinians are going to lose their jobs if SodaStream closes their factory. And that's the hypocrisy of these moves. Not only is it discriminatory and selective, only directed at Israel, they don't direct it in any other, quote, disputed area. Secondly, it blanket affects people who are engaged in health research and doing positive things, and that benefit both Israelis and Arabs, and that they're Arabs who work, the thousands and thousands of them, who will be impacted and put out of work. And in SodaStream, they make an equivalent salary. Israelis and Arabs make the same amount of money, and it's four or five times what they would make in any other job that they would get in the PA, within the Palestinian Authority. Their businesses don't pay. They make certainly a far lower level of standard than in Israel. So the hypocrisy on the surface of this move, but it is serious because it could be a first step, and it's part of the delegitimization campaign, part of the isolation campaign, and they reject the term of a boycott, but in fact, that I use that term deliberately because it is in fact a boycott. We're looking at how the anti-boycott legislation here would affect any companies that in fact abide by the European companies who implement or try to implement this kind of restrictive practice, which we believe is a violation of American anti-boycott law.
So all this is the practical aspect of it. Why do you think, I don't know, psychologically or philosophically, we've gotten to this point between Europe and Israel?
First of all, it is psychological because it's of the isolation. It is practical because the cost that could be involved.
Right.
Israeli institutions and others get many millions of dollars in these, and including R&D, research and development funding. So many people could be impacted. But it's the message to the world that here you have the European Union silent in the face of the persecution of thousands and thousands of Christians, of the violations of human rights everywhere, not able to take a stand on Syria, but they can find the time and the energy and the dedication to go after the situation that they find so objectionable in the West Bank, where thank God nobody's been killed and nobody's persecuted, and whatever differences they may have and whatever violations they may see, it pales in comparison to hundreds of other situations where they have not undertaken this action. And it can be the first step. This is something that gets picked up, that gets expanded, that individual countries are talking it. And I have to say that Secretary Kerry and others have gone to Europe to fight it and to speak against it. And I think you will see more on that effort. This is certainly something the United States government and Canada and others have rejected and spoken out against. It is a serious matter. I am always surprised by how little regard American Jewish audiences have for the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I don't even know what it is. And yet it's being implemented, including the United States, when we see these entertainers not going to Israel, when we see cultural sectors, the unions, the labor churches, others, all being infected by this disease. And it is not something to be dismissed.
Yeah, that's why I'm proud to say for the first time in a long time, we're actually thanking those on the show for those you know, who go and perform and spend time in Israel and tell the world that they are not ready to cave into the boycott calls. It's 2 minutes after 8 o'clock, and this is America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WNYX Montgomery, Rockland County at 91.9 FM, around the world on the web at jmam.org. Malcolm Honlein is with us, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Weekly update today and 2 weeks from today, next week with the Israel trip. We will not be doing the weekly update. The what do you make of the whole Putin-Obama a cool relationship in light of the Snowden episode? I would assume that this is not all about Snowden and that this is really just a highlight of a deeper rift between the two of them.
I do believe, and I've talked on the show for a long time about the impact of the Soviet-U.S. Relationship on particular issues. We see the actions of Putin in countries like Syria, where he's still backing Assad, where he provided the Ahnut, these advanced missiles that Israel had to take out, and there are still some left, or his threats to sell the very advanced S-300 anti-aircraft systems, the presence of their ships, that the situation in Syria is not simply Assad versus the rebels. It's seven or eight layers of war, one of which is competition Saudi U.S. versus Russia. Russia, he is trying to reassert the controls of the former Soviet Union, even without the territory. And for them, this has always been the soft underbelly. And the message he has projected, taking advantage of mistakes the United States has made or perceived mistakes, to say, you know, you may not like our positions, but we are loyal to our friends. And now you see he's going to be visiting Egypt. We see that he's been invited, that he's looking for invitations to other parts of the Middle East. And a very critical meeting took place in Moscow just a week ago or so, and it got very little coverage here. If you look at the Russian papers, it got a front-page picture, and that was a meeting between Prince Mandar of Saudi Arabia, who is the Minister for Intelligence, and Putin. I'm telling you, this is a game changer. And we will see consequences of this. This is not a haphazard thing because the Saudis and the Russians have been long estranged. This is a changer, and it is in part because of the West's failure in the region, and it's in part because of the aggressiveness of Putin, who's a very shrewd guy. I don't know how smart, but he's certainly shrewd in sticks to the directions that he sets, often ones that we don't like. And Snowden is an overlay of it. And the fact that the president had to cancel the trip was a symbol of the significance of this.
One could argue that U.S. policy on Iran also contributes to it. That because of what seems to us as a lackadaisical attitude toward the nuclear buildup in Iran, the Russians see just how weak the United States is perceived against them.
Well, I don't think Iran is the same kind of case. First of all, I think the United States has been stronger, certainly on the sanctions front, than anybody else. And you can point to Europe, much more likely, about the reluctance with which they have come behind it. But the impact was very evident this week in Iran of the sanctions and of the strong stand on sanctions and the fact that the United States has done these military exercises, sending messages, again asserting that the president will not allow nuclear weapons, Iran to have nuclear weapons. It was told to us yesterday, again, by virtually everybody. But you're right, there is a message that's communicated that now you have Rouhani getting elected, and all of a sudden, his middle name is Moderate. And this is a guy who wrote a book saying how he deceived, how he lied, how he, when he was the negotiator, how he obfuscated. He is somebody who has pointed to his cabinet, which is being described, if you've seen the press, as technocrats or bureaucrats or whatever. They are, in fact, people who came out of the security sector, where he came out of, from the Ministry of Intelligence. It does seem to be a clash with guys with the Iran Revolutionary Guard, but it's clearly an attempt to, for him to impose his people. They're not technocrats. These are guys who are going to continue the same policy that existed before. And the revelations about a heavy-duty reactor, which I talked about on the show months ago. I don't know why people all of a sudden are discovering the plutonium reactor could be active by next summer. They've been working on it for a long time, and 76 senators wrote to President Obama about the need not to be diverted by Rouhani's selection, and you know he might put a different face on it, but the policy is the same. Let's see what he does. Right. Let's see if there is, in fact, some sort of a change in policy. Netanyahu said yesterday that 7,000 new centrifuges have been put in place just since June, 1,000 of them the more advanced. We know of a base where they're training Shiites to go into Syria, but they could go into other places as well. And the satellites show now a new ballistic missile site. So they're moving ahead on all the three components, which we've discussed, of a nuclear program: enrichment, missile delivery system, and weaponization. So the idea that all of a sudden that this is a change is completely fictional. He had to be approved by Khamenei, the supreme leader. The supreme leader still runs what goes on. He appointed Zarif, the foreign minister, who was a Holocaust minimizer, I would say, if not denier. A justice minister was accused of being involved in mass murders. So this idea that he is and people searching and wanting to have some option with Iran. If they want to negotiate, they know what steps they have to take.
Now that Ahmadinejad is out of office, will there be less attention on Iran at the UN?
There is less attention already because of Syria and Egypt, and it's one of the reasons why we emphasize it so much now, because this is the number one danger, and it is moving ahead.
Right.
Thank God the members of the House and Senate have gone, and the House voted 400-20 to impose new sanctions. 400-20, including 106 of the 131 members who signed a letter, you know, welcoming Rouhani's election, essentially. It wasn't exactly, but in brief. So they get it, and they see what's really happening there.
Right. I mean, but the attention at the UN will be much less. I'm not talking about whether people are...
The first speech, everybody's going to hang on every word to see, and he won't call for the destruction of Israel.
So he will be invited to...
say a wound, that Israel is a wound on the Islamic body, whatever, and then...
So he will be invited to speak. That's already established.
Yep.
And do we know if the Prime Minister of Israel, with the Yuntif schedule, will be able to speak at the UN?
It is not at all clear yet.
Because
that he will come, and if he comes, that he will speak. But right now, you don't have a foreign minister who often could take his place. So,
right. Oh, good point.
I think the likelihood is the prime minister will come.
A couple of things, just going back, and then we'll go forward. So, on the Putin, President Obama thing, is it a generational thing? In other words, you said that Putin is now behaving essentially without the geographic control. He's essentially behaving or trying to behave in the direction of the old Soviet leadership. Correct. So, does Russia need, you know, new young leadership? Does it need a generational change or some other type of leader to come in? Or essentially, this is the direction that Russia is going to be going in because, hey, this is the orientation of, you know, the way things work on that side of the world.
Well, I think Russia has moved away from the surge towards democracy that we saw.
Right.
He has put his own people in, mostly KGB, former KGB, as he was the head of it. But they have specific interests. One of them is, and they are apoplectic about Chechnya, and any kind of moves of radicalization. That's why he opposed regime change, because he's afraid that it could spread.
Right.
You know, Russia has a huge Muslim population. It has these territories. They are radicalized. They killed tens of thousands of people in Chechnya. And for them, the Middle East areas have been their soft underbelly traditionally, going back hundreds of years. They still, I think, are very concerned about Turkey, for instance. They want also to reassert their role, and so they look for any opportunity to be center stage and demonstrate their commitment by blocking moves at the UN on Syria, blocking moves.
Right. But in theory, if there was a change of administration, would it be much different?
It depends who gets elected.
Understood, but I'm trying to, like...
I mean, he also has big economic problems at home. He has other difficulties. Right now, there's nobody on the horizon that would change things.
Right. But that push to democracy, as you just described, is not really... It's not there anymore, and I guess I'm just wondering if there's any potential for it, you know, if somebody else, in
fact...
Well,
you remember, there were big demonstrations in Moscow, and there is opposition being expressed. But right now, I would say he is solid...
And going back to the peace process for a moment, I wanted to add the issue of the new settler homes that were approved. I apologize to everybody who hates the term, but I don't know how else to refer to it right now. And there has been approval, correct? There has been approval for expansion in certain areas. Isn't it strange that Netanyahu is making such gestures, and like the prisoner release, to get everybody back at the table, yet of course this becomes, meaning the homes, becomes such a big issue again?
Well, any gesture, any move, and remember, this is not actual construction. This is just approvals, which
right.
take years to implement. Second, most of the construction, if not all, is within the existing footprints of the communities. The ones that are getting approval that you've referred to are places like Gilo or in communities that exist already and whose boundaries are clear, and these are areas that are going to remain with Israel in virtually all scenarios. So it is not kind of it's not a slap in the face and some sort of a massive gesture. The Palestinians play on it, and it gives them cover that if the negotiations break, they say, "Oh, you see, it's because of the settlements, not because of their unwillingness or unreadiness to take the steps necessary to have serious negotiations when all these issues will be discussed."
Right.
All these issues can come up.
And I guess no matter when there's a construction approval, it's always going to be an...
And you remember when Joe Biden, Vice President
yeah, of
Biden
course.
Was there and you had an announcement? That was an announcement by a third-level Pakid Bureau.